And so that's exactly what we've been talking about when we've been walking through the book of the Gospel of Mark. And we're right at the halfway point, the midpoint of the Gospel, chapter 8. We're calling this Jesus 101. And if you remember, a couple of times I've mentioned over the last few weeks that there's 16 chapters in Mark. It divides right in two equal parts, basically. So the first eight chapters ask a question, and the second eight chapters ask a different question. And the question that is asked in those first eight chapters is, who is Jesus? That's the basic question. Who is Jesus? And so as we've walked along, we've been able to see some, you know, we haven't covered every single verse, but we're beginning to get a picture, I think, I hope, I pray, that we're getting a clearer picture of who Jesus is. And when we get into the next chapter, or just after this section, the question shifts, the focus shifts, and we get this kind of this intense focus on the cross. And so the last part of the book is focused on why did he die? So we're talking about who Jesus is right this morning, and we're coming to basically the focal point of the book, where the whole focus again shifts. Some of you may know an author by the name of H.G. Wells. It's going back a little ways, but you know how some of these things come back, right? Books are written and movies are made of them, and then they're redone, and then they're redone again. And so H.G. Wells wrote a book. The most famous one is The War of the Worlds, and that's been done, I think, several times. And he wrote a book called The Invisible Man, and he also wrote a book not as familiar, but it's called The Country of the Blind. Country of the Blind. And it's about this little valley in Ecuador, imaginary valley, it doesn't actually exist. It's in a place that was so remote and so isolated that really nobody knew about it. But there were people who lived in this valley over hundreds and hundreds of years, and somehow way back when, some kind of a disease moved into that little valley, and every single one of them were struck with this illness, which left them blind. And so generation after generation, this disease was passed on from one generation to the next. And so for 15 generations, every single person in that valley in Ecuador was blind. Born blind, lived their whole lives blind, never saw anything. And so they had no concept of color and shape and what things looked like in nature. They learned to function with their other senses, but none of them knew what things looked like. And they were so isolated from the outside world that no one would ever come to tell them what the outside world looked like, what it was like to live as a person with sight. But in the story, one day a man is literally dropped into the valley. He falls off a cliff and he rolls down into the valley, finds himself there in this hidden valley in Ecuador with these blind people, and he can see. And so he's getting to know them, and he's trying to explain to them who he is and what his life is like. And so he'll sit down day after day and explain to them, you know, what a tree looks like, what a bird looks like, what the sky is like, what they look like to him through his eyes. And they just kept listening to him and kind of, you know, with these puzzled looks on their faces and couldn't quite relate to him. In fact, they thought he was crazy. And see, nobody for 15 generations had ever seen anything. And so can you imagine trying to communicate to someone what things look like when you haven't had the use of your eyes and no one else has had it down through the ages? But as these stories tend to do, right, he fell in love with one of the blind girls there. And so he falls in love with this girl. But her father is quite disturbed about this fact, because this guy's kind of odd, right? He's always talking about this stuff that he can see that no one can relate to at all. And he thinks, they really kind of think he's nuts, right? So he's not too keen about his daughter marrying this man. And so he goes to a local doctor, and the doctor examines the young man and says, well, really, says to the father-in-law, says, you know, he's actually, I think he's insane. You know, he's kind of crazy, because he's always talking about this stuff. And so the father says, well, what can we do about this? Well, it's actually a simple solution. You know, all you need to do is to remove those things that are causing the insanity. And it's quite a simple operation. We'll just remove the eyes, and then he will be perfectly sane again, just like the rest of us. And this, you know, the young man loved the young daughter of this man, and he considered it for a while. He went off in the woods and the meadows, and he thought, well, I'll just take a few hours. I'll look at everything again, and just this will be my last look, right, before they take my eyes out. He said, my last look at everything. And he considered that. He spent the next few hours and decided, you know, really, it wasn't worth it to lose his sight over that. And the cure was not worth the pain and the loss. So the story ends with him, you know, escaping with his life and with his eyes and his eyesight, and he goes on with his life. And the people in the valley continue their life in blindness and darkness. Chapter 8 of Mark is kind of like that. It's really, in a sense, all about blindness. And so in that chapter, there's a story of one person who is literally physically blind, who Jesus heals. But there's also the story of two groups of people who are blind in another way, spiritually blind. And we're going to find this morning, as we look at this, the answer to one of the most important questions that you will ever want to answer. And we'll look at some of the things about why some people get it and some people don't. Some people remain as it is in their blindness. The focal point of the story, as I said before, is this question. There's a question that Jesus asks. He says to Peter and the disciples, who do people say that I am? Who do people say that I am? So what I want to do is I want to start at the beginning, and we'll take a section at a time, and we'll look at these different forms of blindness. So we'll start in chapter 8, verse 1, and go to the 13th verse to start off with. This focus is on the disciples, a familiar story here. It says, during those days, another large crowd gathered. Since they had nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples to him and said, I have compassion for these people. They have already been with me for 3 days and have nothing to eat. If I send them home hungry, they will collapse on the way because some of them have come a long distance. His disciples answered, but where in this remote place can anyone get enough bread to feed them? Now, if you've been reading through Mark, you'll know that in Mark chapter 6, Jesus fed 5,000. There's 4,000 people this day. It's a different group of people, different place. But the disciples have already watched him take their meager resources, a few loaves and a few fish, and feed a group of 5,000 people. So they say this is probably a few months later, but here we have almost the exact same circumstance. And the disciples are going, you know, we only have a few loaves of bread. You know, how are we going to feed these 4,000 people? So they're looking at their own resources again, even though they've been in this circumstance before with Jesus and have seen what he can do in a circumstance like that, and yet somehow they can't quite put the two together. You know, Jesus fed 5,000 people with our meager resources before. Here's another circumstance, very much like the one before. Where are we going to get some bread, Jesus? There's a disconnect here, right? They're not quite putting together the pieces of the puzzle. They're not quite seeing it. And so Jesus says something. I think he's trying to twig their memory. He says, how many loaves do you have? Jesus asked. And seven, they replied. It's actually the exact same question he asked them a few months before when he fed 5,000. He said, how many loaves do you have? The exact same words. I think he's trying to say, do you kind of recall what I did this last time? You watched it. You were part of that. Do you remember that? He told the crowd to sit down on the ground. When he had taken the seven loaves and given thanks, he broke them and gave them to his disciples to set before the people, and they did so. They had a few small fish as well. He gave thanks for them also and told the disciples to distribute them. The people ate and were satisfied. Afterward, the disciples picked up seven basketfuls of broken pieces that were left over. About 4,000 men were present. And having sent them away, he got into the boat with his disciples and went to the region of Dalmanutha. So here they are in the same situation again. I think what's happening here, one of the things that's happening is we're so used to, and they were so used to, kind of living their life on the basis of your own resources. you know, it's up to me to muddle through in this situation. So here again, we have this need. It's much greater than I can manage. So how am I going to do this? How am I going to figure this out? And Jesus is trying to remind them of what he has done in the past and what he is so capable of doing for them again. You know, it really is true. Your resources are inadequate. How many times do you have to relearn the same lessons? Now, lest we kind of get really hard on those disciples, you and I probably are the same way, right? You and I probably have been taught some lessons in our lives. We've seen how God has worked in some situations, but we find ourselves in some very similar, if not exactly the same, circumstances, and we say, you know, how am I going to muddle through this? How am I going to get through this on my own? With my resources, as little as they are. And so we have to keep learning over and over and over again, at least for me, the same old lessons, right? Jesus takes us through that lesson again and says, Do you remember the time when you were in this circumstance and I brought you through it, when I provided for you, when I worked in your life some healing, when I opened a door for you, when I guided you into this new thing, when you prayed and I answered prayers for you? Do you remember that? Well, here we are again, kind of in a very similar circumstance. I'm the same God. You know, do you remember how I can work in your life? But somehow they don't quite see. They're still not putting all of the pieces together. There's a kind of spiritual blindness, right? Or a spiritual amnesia that sets in sometimes where we don't see what's going on around us. We don't remember how God has worked in our lives and we can't apply it to this new circumstance. Our vision is clouded. We don't really see. Our memories are short. And so Jesus has to repeat the lesson over again. And we talked a week or so ago about how Jesus, you know, he talked to the Pharisees and said, "You're hypocrites," but he talked to his own disciples who had given up everything to follow him and said, "You know, you're kind of dull. You're kind of slow. You're not too quick on the uptake here. You're not putting the pieces together." And so they're still struggling with this. Let's go on to verse 11. It says, "The Pharisees came and they began to question Jesus to test him. They asked him for a sign from heaven. He sighed deeply and said, 'Why does this generation ask for a miraculous sign? I tell you the truth, no sign will be given to it.' Then he left them, got back into the boat, and crossed to the other side." So here's another kind of blindness. And it's the blindness of the Pharisees. And it's a blindness that's self-imposed. They refuse to see what's right in front of them. And they've decided that Jesus can't be what he says he is. He doesn't fit their paradigm, right? He doesn't fit their model for what the Messiah, the Christ, should be and do and look like. And so it doesn't matter what evidence there is, right? It doesn't matter, really. I mean, Jesus has presented them with lots of signs and miracles already. And yet they say, "Well, give us a sign. You know, give us a sign to prove to us who you are." And I don't think it mattered. It's not that he's being ignorant about it and saying, "I'm not going to give you a sign." I really don't think it would matter. You know, at that very moment, he could kind of say, you know, that the sun will be eclipsed or the heavens would change or, you know, something could happen. And really, they're looking for a sign from heaven from him. They would probably say, "Well, there's probably a scientific..." Well, they probably wouldn't use those terms. "But there's probably another explanation for what's happening right now. And we really don't believe. So give us another sign. And another sign." There's never going to be enough signs to prove to them that he is who he says he is. There's never enough evidence because they're blind. Jesus said, "You are like blind guides." They demand proof, even though they've already had more than enough proof of who he is. It doesn't really matter. And I think what it is, and many people do this, right? They're always saying, "You know, God, prove yourself to me. You know, I'll believe if you only prove yourself to me." But the thing is, he'll do it, and they'll still say, "Well, just, you know, give me another proof. You know, just show yourself to me. How many proofs are enough? When is it going to be the time when you say, you know, actually, the reason I'm not believing is because I really just, it's kind of an excuse to avoid the commitment that God is calling me." So they refuse to acknowledge the signs that are right in front of their eyes. They're blind. And they don't admit that there's things that they're just not seeing. They're right there, but they won't admit that they're not seeing. And that's really the worst kind of blindness, because they refuse to acknowledge the truth. Now, as we move on, you know, we can get fairly smug about this, can't we? And we can kind of say those, you know, those dull disciples and those hypocritical Pharisees. And it's easy to see that, or not to see, that we can actually be guilty of the same things. And so Jesus warns them. He warns his own disciples and says this in verse 14. Disciples had forgotten to bring bread, except for one loaf they had with them in the boat. And he says, be careful. Jesus warned them, watch out for the yeast of the Pharisees and that of Herod. They discussed this one with one another and said, is because we have no bread. So Jesus is not holding a baking class here, right? He's not saying, you should have had some yeast with you so we could bake some bread for ourselves. He's not talking about bread, and he's not talking about yeast. He's using it as an analogy, a metaphor for something, right? And so yeast, I know very little about this because I don't bake. But anyway, it when you put it in the lump of dough, right, it'll work its way through the whole thing, right? So yeast in the scriptures is an image, a metaphor for evil or for corruption or something that kind of infiltrates a group or an individual, and it kind of spreads through the whole thing. And so he's saying here, just be careful. Watch out for this. Because this attitude, this way of looking at life is contagious. It can spread, right? You know, it's very easy for you to be condemning and critical of the Pharisees, but it would be just as easy for you to take on those same attitudes and actions yourself. It's just like yeast. It can spread through the whole lump. And so the Pharisees, their yeast, the yeast of the Pharisees is their legalism. It's their self-righteousness. It's their hard hearts. Jesus said that they refuse to believe. It's their spiritual blindness, that it doesn't matter how many signs you give them, it's never enough. There's always has to be one more. That kind of thing, it's pride. It's spiritual pride. That kind of thing is very contagious. It's easy to condemn them, but we're not immune from it. We can be infected. And so Jesus said, be careful, watch out. Those same attitudes can creep into your life as well. And so he goes on and he says, do you still not understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes but fail to see, and ears but fail to hear? So, you know, spiritually blind, spiritually deaf. When I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many basketful of pieces did you pick up? 12, they replied. When I broke the 7 loaves for the 4,000, how many basketfuls of pieces did you pick up? And they answered, 7. And he said to them, do you still not understand? So, you know, they can rattle off the details of the story, right? Yeah, I was there. I remember. I saw you. I know how many loaves of bread, how many that we had, and how many baskets were left. And I can tell you all of the details, but they don't know what it means, right? It hasn't clicked to them what the significance of that event was, who that should have shown them that Jesus was. You know, he's no ordinary man. This is not just a prophet. This is not just a rabbi, a teacher, not just a good man. This is someone totally, completely different than that. But they still don't understand. They still don't understand. There's still a spiritual blindness that they're struggling with. They can't quite see. And so they have this discussion, and he says, don't you understand? You know, there's a book that was written. It's called An Anthropologist on Mars, which I haven't read. It sounds like an interesting book. Where this neurologist, Oliver Sacks, he talks about a man by the name of Virgil. And Virgil, who was 50, became blind in his early childhood. And so just about his whole life he was blind. But when he was 50, he had an operation because, of course, science advances, right? In his early days, they couldn't have cured his blindness. But when he was 50, it had advanced enough that they could carry out an operation to restore his sight. And so they did that. And they took off the bandages from his eyes, and he opened his eyes, and he looked, and he began to see colors and shapes and things in the room, but he really wasn't sure. He couldn't kind of make a connection as to what those things were. You know, there was light, and he was excited about that, but he wasn't sure what those things were. It took a long time for him to make the connection. So the eyes were functioning, but the brain wasn't interpreting the messages that were coming through his optic nerves. And that took some time. And the doctor described the whole process, and it said this man, Virgil, for a number of months, was acting like he was still blind, even though he could see, but he was functioning like a blind man because his brain, you know, just couldn't quite put the things together. And that's exactly kind of, it's like the way the disciples were. They're, you know, all this input, right? All this information about Jesus over the last 3 years that they've had this relationship with him, traveling and watching him teach and preach and heal and deliver people from demons. That, you know, you could imagine trying to put that all together. They were seeing it. They could detail the stories, right, of what had happened, but they weren't quite sure what it meant completely. But it's kind of like we're starting to see, right? We're starting to see it, but we're not sure. And so we have this story that comes right after that, which is kind of interesting the way it's been placed, about a blind man. It says, they came to Bethsaida, and some people brought a blind man and begged Jesus to touch him. He took the blind man by the hand and led him outside the village. And when he had spit on the man's eyes and put his hands on him, Jesus asked, "Do you see anything?" He looked up and said, "I see people. They look like trees walking around." Imagine if you're a blind man, that's the first thing you see, right? You see some movement, you see something out there, but you're not really sure what it is. Maybe, you know, he probably had sight earlier in his life because he knew what a tree was, right? So he said, it looks kind of like trees moving around. I'm not sure what it is. And so there needed to be another touch in his life. So once more, Jesus put his hands on the man's eyes, and then his eyes were opened, his sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. And Jesus sent him home saying, "Don't go into the village." So there's a man who is blind. Jesus heals him, but it takes another touch, right? There's this fuzziness. He can't quite put together what all of this means until Jesus touches him again. And so it's kind of like where the disciples are. And so Jesus asks them a question. In verse 27, he says, "Jesus and his disciples went into the village around Caesarea Philippi. And on the way, he asked them, 'Who do people say I am? Who do people say I am?' And they replied, 'Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and others one of the prophets.'" So there's all sorts of things going around, right? All sorts of things that people are saying about Jesus. And so they're saying, you know, he's like John the Baptist. Herod himself thought, you know, it's John the Baptist whom I had killed, come back to life. That's who Jesus is. Or it's Elijah, one of the greatest prophets in the Old Testament, come back to life. So this is a man of power, but he's a prophet. He's not God in the flesh. No one is saying Jesus is Messiah. You know, that's not one of the things it seems like people are talking about in the coffee shops, right? That Jesus is Messiah. That's not one of them. They're saying he's a great man, he's a great teacher, he's a powerful prophet, but that's all. And so these days, you know, you have a conversation with someone and ask them the question, "Who do you say Jesus is?" And you may come up with all sorts of answers, right? He was a good man. He was a good teacher. Moral, you know, his principles are great things to live by, right? He was a founder of a religion. He was a guy that lived a long time ago. All sorts of ideas of who Jesus is. But not very many people get it in that day. You know, it didn't really click with very many people. Most of them just had a partial idea of who he is and was. And so Jesus asks another question. He says, but what about you? Who do you say I am? And so good old Peter, right? He's usually the first one to either stick his foot in it or to do the right thing, right? He speaks for everyone, all of the disciples, and he says, "You are the Christ. You are the Christ." And Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. In Matthew, there's a little fuller description of this, and it says that Peter said, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And then Jesus comes back to him, and he says, "You know, you're blessed. You're blessed, Peter, because you didn't figure this out just with your own intelligence. You know, you didn't just kind of sit down one day and work this out in your mind." He said, "Your heavenly Father revealed this to you, and you are blessed." So, you know, Peter, and I guess some of the other disciples, it's starting to get clear, right? They're starting to see Jesus is beginning to heal their spiritual blindness. But the key to that is the only way that you're going to come to know Jesus and to really see him for who he is if the Father reveals him to you. You need to receive your spiritual sight from God. You need divine intervention to be healed from that spiritual blindness. To see him as more than kind of like those trees walking around, right? Fuzzy. We're not quite sure who he is. Have a little bit of a clue, but we're not quite sure. But now it's becoming clear. And it makes a huge, huge difference. Actually, if you go on to the next section, you'll see that Peter doesn't quite fully get it, right? Because Jesus talks about, it says, from this moment on, this is the fulcrum, right? This is the turning point. He says, from this moment on, Jesus started talking about how he was going to suffer and how he was going to die. He's going to be delivered up and he was going to die. And so he starts talking about this, and Peter says, no, you can't. That can't be it. That's not the way the Messiah is going to go. That's not how it's going to go for you. And so Jesus says, get behind me, Satan. You know, you don't have the things of God in mind. You have the same things of man in mind. So Peter is still not quite clear, right? He still didn't get the whole picture of who Jesus is and what needed to happen. But that's okay, right? If it was you or me in that position, maybe we wouldn't put it all together at that point either. We have the benefit of hindsight, don't we? We have the benefit of looking back and seeing the whole story, right? As Jesus moves toward the cross and the resurrection. And the disciples didn't really get it until after that either, did they? You know, Jesus had to unpack it for them and to explain what all this was about. But it should make a huge, it makes a huge, huge difference how you answer that question that Jesus asks. His most important question you can ever answer in your life. Who am I? Jesus asks us, who do you say I am? You know, is he just a good teacher? Is he just a good example to follow? Is he just a prophet? Is he just, you know, any of these other options that are out there? There's so many of them. Or is he the Christ, the Messiah, the anointed one, the King of all kings, the Son of God, the one who came to save you and deliver you from your sins to set you free? Who is Jesus? If he's all those things, you know, it transforms our lives completely. The disciples, at one point in John chapter 6, Jesus is talking about his death. And it says that people were leaving in droves. They were leaving because he was talking about all of this difficult stuff and they didn't want to hear it. It didn't fit their paradigm of what the Messiah should do and be like. And Jesus turns to his few disciples and he says, are you going to walk away too? And Peter again says, well, who would we go to? You know, you have the words of life. Who else would we turn to? So they'd given up everything. And it didn't matter if everyone else abandoned him. You know, where else would we go? Who else would we follow? You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. So I guess I'm asking you, if everybody abandoned Jesus, if your whole family abandoned you because of your faith in Christ, would you still continue to follow him? Or would you walk away? If they're trying to lead you away from him, would you still continue to follow him? Because he is the only one who has the words of life. He is the Christ, the Son of the living God. How you answer that question makes all the difference in the world.